I seem to remember I gave you a copy of the full report. If not, I've got at least one copy and I can make more for you. But this came out recently, and I know two of you have seen this before. Dave, I don't think you've seen it.
No, I think I've had a copy of it.
A copy, but not the actual briefing.
No.
And last week, the same team, with Laura and I.
Michael Tweet.
You know, gave the briefing to the folks over in SQIM at our PDD/RC&D meeting and took some questions. And we had talked about with our new light industrial park at the airport that we've got to start doing infrastructure and everything else and some other properties. You know, is agriculture an industry sector that the port can play in? And it was interesting, yesterday I went through some archives. I remember seeing it before. And going back, July 25th, 1926, the port was 1 year old. Our first commission meeting was a year and a half old. Our first commission meeting was January 25. Port of Port Townsend, Municipal Corporation, Jefferson County, Washington, offers excellent opportunities for pulp, paper plants, lumber, shingle, lathe, veneer mills, logging enterprises, cannery, fruits, vegetables, fish, dairies, cheese factories, poultry, berry, vegetables, livestock ranching, mountain, seaside, and river recreation. And it goes on. So this was in the Seattle paper, and they sent it to the, remember the old magazine, the Post?
Post Intelligence, sir?
No, the magazine. Yeah, yeah, back when Life and all those were big magazines back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Saturday Evening Post.
Saturday Evening Post. I found a letter where Hamilton Higday, first port director, sent it to them for publishing. So we've got a history here, and I'm just wondering if, you know, life is a circle, and maybe we've come back to where we began. So with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much. So Larry really set this up nicely. Michael did present this at the last RC&D meeting, and WSU was involved with the effort to help put the survey together. So the survey was done by Citizens for Local Food, which is a really informal group of county citizens who came together, very different sort of political backgrounds and sentiments, but they had one common, this very common belief in wanting to understand what the agricultural activity in the county looked like. And it was sort of modeled after a survey that was done in the San Juan Islands, and also some work that had been done in Whatcom County in the Methow Valley, looking at how different communities can feed themselves. So do they have the capacity to feed themselves and so forth? So this survey was undertaken, I guess it was started 2 years ago.
Yes.
And it was finished this fall. And Michael and I have been associated on some other research projects as well. So I invited him to be able to come in and speak because we do collaborate beyond just Citizens for Local Food. And Michael's capacity with the project was really with a lot of the data analysis and organizing the data that was collected with his background in statistics. So you should be able to kind of get into, if you have some more detailed questions about, you know, how the data was compiled or, you know, how they came to some of the results, I'm hoping you'll be able to give a good good background for that. So I'm going to let him go ahead and present some data from the survey, and then I can come in afterwards and talk about some of the areas that just from the survey data, but also conversations that we've had with agricultural producers and processors in the county and the region, what some of the really pertinent needs are in the community for infrastructure.
Well, hi, my name is Michael Tweeten again. I am an ecologist and I have a background in environmental studies and science and statistics, analyzing data. Because of that, I got interested in local food, mainly because of climate change reasons, that if you don't have to transport lettuces from Mexico, that's a huge, much lower impact if you can grow them. And then that supports the local economy. So that's how what brought me into the project. But we really were a very diverse group of people, not just in terms of our why we came there, points of view, but also just the skills that showed up. And it really shows, to me anyway, that when you kind of set out on a mission, like, we really want to make food work here in Jefferson County, it really brings in kind of the people you need. Like graphic artists, so we have someone who did children's books, and she made this thing really look good. We also had data analysis people, and people who are interested in interviewing farmers. So this whole process was based on an hour and a half long interview with as many of the food producers in Jefferson County as we could get to agree to do it. Going through the list of people knew and asking around, we identified in eastern Jefferson County, so it's just the eastern portion, 87 farmers who, to one degree or another, were interested in farming commercially.
Excuse me, could you hold on a minute? Hey, Rick, why don't you pull the chair over here so you can see the screen?
Thank you. That will help us.
We only got a hold of about 80 of them, and out of those 80, 57 actually agreed to do this 1.5 hour interview to volunteer. So that's a 71% response rate. And so this was a really kind of a outpouring of the voice of the farmers. They really wanted to talk to people about their issues and get them out there. And all we're trying to do as a group, even though there's a lot of other things we'd like this to turn into, one way or the other, mainly this thing is just trying to articulate what it is that they're saying about themselves, what it is that they see as their problems, and what it is that they see as the solutions that they'd like to see be worked on more. Before I get into the details, though, I mean, there's three main things I think that come out of it. First is that that demand for local products, like just more people buying what local people produce, is the main issue. And also profitability, having them be able to get enough money to support themselves doing these enterprises when they do make sales. And the last thing is cooperation, that the farmers are really willing to think outside the box and come up with different ways of collaborating with different groups and also cooperating with each other in order to make those two problems be better. So demand, profitability, and cooperation are the three main messages here. So who are the farmers? Then we have a lot more information about this in the report. We found two groups in terms of ages. About two-thirds of them are older than 50 years old, and they're the ones who are on the farm, some of which go back 160 years. There is a distinct cohort, though, in their 20s and 30s, about a quarter of the farmers we interviewed, and they're mostly working on new farms that are less than 10 years old. And that sounds obvious, so they're young, their farms are new, but that means that the young people are coming and starting farms from the ground up, but they're not coming in and inheriting from older people. And very interestingly, 81% of them have a college degree or a graduate degree. And these are graduate degrees and college degrees in like agroecology and different types of farming specialties. So when we went and spoke to them, we asked, like, who is it that speaks for the farm? And one person would come forward. It tended to be, if there was a family, it tended to be the guy. But sometimes it was the woman. And so we have what we're calling families here. So there's a family involved, like partners. And here the woman is the one speaking for the farm. Here the man was. Some of them also didn't have any family associated operation. They were just a single person. So we're calling them single men or women. And then we looked at to see, and then they tell us like how many people were working for them and their hours and all that. So who is actually hiring help? And you can see that the families, it's right around 70% of them hire additional help to help them out on the farm. Whereas the single operators tend to not do that yet. They're very low. And especially the single men, only 20% of them actually hire anyone else. And so these are actually guys by themselves on the farm trying to get a commercial operation going. About a third of the farms are entirely family labor, and but many of them hire help. And there's over 300 people in these farms I've interviewed, about 310. So that's a pretty large labor force there. 18% of those 300 people are hired hands. 13% of them are barter workers, where they're exchanging labor for food or other types of, mainly that. And then 6% of them are interns who are involved in some kind of formal or slightly less formal program, field program, the program called flippers, where people travel around and from various farms.
Michael?
Yeah.
Did you say there was 300 people working here?
A little bit over 300 on the farms that we talked to. So the actual number is a little bit more than that, as we only talked to 7%.
And it didn't include people who were processing agricultural goods. So some farms do some value added, but then you have other people who are doing value added with local agricultural products, and they were not included in this. And aquaculture was also not included. There's an effort to do a separate survey, but like the survey didn't fit in with aquaculture, and obviously that's huge industry related to agricultural production. So.
Yeah, I meant to mention that at the beginning. We originally were going to interview shellfish producers, but we did a few of those, and the questionnaire was really thought of kind of land-based, and so they didn't feel like the questionnaire was really being very relevant to them, and so we said we'd table that, and then yeah, there's another effort going to talk to them about that.
And I want to point out that the most of the data that we have right now about farming in Jefferson County comes from the 2007 agricultural census, and they just completed the 2012 agricultural census. It was completed, the last reporting date was at the end of January of 2013. That data will be available soon, and so a lot of what we knew before this was based on the 2007 USDA census data for this region, and that will be updated soon. And they do include shellfish in their data, and that was the largest economic driver of ag from 2007 was shellfish production. So, and they estimated about 200 farms in Jefferson County in 2007, so it'll be interesting to see where that number is.
And yeah, I'm interested in that too, because when you come down to it, it's a little bit difficult to figure out where that came from. Half of them said that they're actually interested in hiring more labor. They could usually they could get more income. So they as a workforce would like to grow. And what are they producing on the land?
You get the border patrol out of here, you probably have a lot of help.
I don't know. There's actually other issues. The housing being another one, which I don't get into in this version. So about 41% of them are livestock farmers. And that includes people who grow pasturage or hay for livestock. We put those into the cattle livestock category. 32% of them are growing vegetable crops or berries or fruit. And then 20% of them are doing a combination of both plant and animal products. Which maps onto how these farms are set up in a lot of different ways. Livestock farms, on average, are quite large, like 111 acres was the average size of the livestock operation. The both crop and livestock was 67 acres, and the just vegetable crops farms are, on average, 9 acres in size. So they're, it's, you know, large number of them, but they're actually quite small parcels that they're utilizing. And, but it also goes along with how long they've been in operation. So these big livestock farms are also the ones that are quite old. Their average age is 44 years. The combination ones are about 22 years old on average, and those crop ones are 10 years. And so if you think back to the age distribution, these are also what the younger people, 20s and 30s coming in, are starting up crop-only operations on small parcels. Many of them are doing value-added, about half of them do it, and a lot of them are interested in actually expanding that, but they identify a lot of hurdles to increasing the value-added production. Value-added meaning taking their primary crop and turning it into additional jelly or jam or cheese or whatnot. It's interesting, though. I mean, think of cheese as a value-added product or yogurt or something, but that's actually not mainly what's going on. The farms that produce crops have are twice as much value-added production as the ones that are just doing livestock. So you actually have a lot of small parcels, younger people, they're trying to get an operation going, and they're actually trying to diversify that into this value-added production chain.
So the farmer is actually doing the value-added?
Right. And like I said, I don't have the slides that show this, but about half of them do that. They're selling their product, but they're also doing value-added.
That makes sense. The livestock producer, he's pretty much just going to sell his beef cattle or hogs or whatever, and somebody else is going to go off in the book.
But we do have people getting into cheese making, so there is some artisan cheese and micro dairies that are starting up. They would be included in livestock.
And the goats are a good example of that.
Yeah.
And they have to be turned into cheese to be sold. We looked at like where people were selling their products. And so if you looked at the sales, like overall, like all the sales, the dollar value of the sales, these are the percentages of the different types of outlets. So 22% of the sales are in wholesale. So that has a lot to do with the hay and cattle. 23% of the sales are in retail outlets, like the PT Food Co-op or Chimney Stand or some retail in Collin County. 5% of sales are at restaurants, 17% at the farmer's market, 3% are at big fairs or events, and 31% of the sales, which is the largest category, are direct sales, which is direct farmer to consumer sales, like a CSA program or on the farm stand, or like off the back of my truck or to my neighbor kind of sales. So what that means, though, is that most people don't actually see the biggest chunk of sales, wholesale and direct sales. Like half of the money coming in isn't in retail, farmer's market kind of menu. And really interestingly, I think a third or three quarters of the sales, 75%, are within Jefferson County. And so these farm operations really are very local in their focus, and only a quarter of these are outside. And when you look at that, most of that is either to Kitsap or Plowin County. And so this is a really highly locally, geographically focused set of producers. I mean, more so than most other farming places. My family farms in Benton County, and the east side, wheat, and it's all about getting it to the granary and shipping it, around the world, feed the world. We want to feed ourselves here in Jefferson County. Looking at the sales, though, we noticed that the different operations really had really different amounts of sales at different outlets. And so we dug into that a bit and found that there were sort of three different strategies that these farms were employing. The most farms are doing this, what we came to call retail diverse. So in this group, which is the one that has the most retail sales, they average about 43% of their sales at retail. It's not the majority, but it's the most of anybody. And when they're doing retail, they're also having to do every other kind of outlet. They're doing farmers markets, they're doing the wholesale, they're doing direct sales, they're kind of generalists. There's another smaller group, but they have a pretty strong signal that about 18% of the farms specialize entirely in farmers markets, where they average about 70% or more, sometimes 100% of their sales at farmers markets. And then there's a last group, which is a large group, 40% of the farms. And they're actually specializing in direct sales through CSAs or off their farm stand or sort of informal transactions, where about 80% of their sales are this direct nature. And so these farms actually, in terms of like the commercial sphere, are almost completely off the radar. And it's a strategy that some of them are choosing to do.
Excuse me. We're primarily in a position to deal with agricultural efforts in a way where we can provide something that's needed, possibly.
Right.
So could you spend, a large amount of times saying what they need?
I'm getting to that very, very shortly.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I'll just go really quickly then through the economic situation. We, I mean, we're asking our, so they're making these sales, and they're investing in the local community, and they are specializing in different ways of doing that, but are they actually making a sustainable living? And we found two different groups, and this is actually sort of important to get to your point, like what could someone like you or anyone else do to help give you capacities? You need to understand like who it is that you're dealing with, what their different needs are. And so there's two income groups, and they actually have different needs in terms of aid from other people or what would help them. And it's a basic, take their gross income, their total receipts, the revenue, on that gross income. And there's basically two groups, a group that makes over $50,000 a year and is making under $50,000. There's some differences between them in terms of their demographics. And they also have differences in their sort of investment and infrastructure. So this larger group has bigger median acreages. It has a great percentage of land for leasing, so they're actually leasing land in order to keep their, the size of the operation. And they have a much larger investment in their on-the-farm infrastructure. Their median square footage of farm structures, like barns, houses, greenhouses, I mean, it vary depending on the crops or animals, is 1,600 square feet, whereas on the smaller group, their investment is less than that, 20,000. So that's something to think about. These people might need infrastructure development that's outside of their farm operation. They don't have the on-the-farm structures already, and they don't have the capital, actually, to build this. This group actually tends to specialize in mixed animal and plant products, and they tend to go the retail route, whereas the smaller grossing group tends to actually be focused more on animal products and more of the crop products. They have a lot of value-added going on here. And they are doing the direct sales in the farmers markets. And so it's kind of like these two different ways of helping farmers. And you can think of a different way that you may be able to help someone who's trying to do retail, who has a lot of infrastructure already, and maybe many who are
our efforts have mainly to do with infrastructure. What can we provide?
And that's what I'm going to get to the very end. Okay. So I have a whole set of ideas based on this work and then other work that we've done in the county.
Just to finish up the point, though, this group tended to work less, and that's because they are mainly reliant on a second job to make this. This is an additional income stream for their family, but they also completely rely on another income stream, either a pension, Social Security, or another spouse's work, or they have two jobs. Farming job, their day job, and most of them would not be able to continue farming if they didn't have that. Whereas the larger group, only about half of them, but that's half, that's quite a lot, need that extra income source in order to make a farm. So actually, the important thing is that these farms are all very edgy economically. Any kind of like loss of a job or disability of one of the people involved in that, or some sort of calamity in terms of the operation, could actually cause them to stop farming. And the profitability ratios are not very high. We looked at all of them, and more than half, or less than a 10% ratio of how much money they actually keep at the end of it versus how much they earn. So they earn $100,000, they keep $10,000, or they earn $10,000, then they keep $1,000. It's a very low margin. And 40% had no profit at all. So they need something a little bit more going on here, which is what we all want to help them with. So what did they identify as what stands in the way? We had this sort of these open-ended discussion questions and these interviews, and we broke them down into phrases to find out what the common themes were. And then we put them into this word diagram here just to show you. And the bigger the phrase is, the more times it was said across all these. And so the big one that comes out is the lack of demand. And they're focused on Jefferson County. So we're not trying to advocate a position, but there's a lot of people who saw that and said, well, if we're not getting enough demand here, maybe they need reaching out, even the small people, the ones who don't have a lot of infrastructure, they need some way of reaching out and getting the bigger market for products. Regulations, which I'll talk about in a second, were identified as a problem. Lack of capital So them having to put on all their transportation into their own, not sharing in transportation actually adds up a lot of costs. Even if they're sort of driving around by themselves, and that adds up.
What about water limitations?
Yeah, some people mentioned that, and it was a very particular thing. Like a few farms, they really felt like they were limited by water, but in general, the same. So I think it didn't come out, and we asked about it. We had a lot of questions about water. No one was identifying water as a limitation.
Yeah, and I've never had someone come to my office last year and have water be a limitation for the system.
So. Where it fits in is what they worry about water is how water relates to all the other environmental issues we have, regulations, and then having what they have to be taken away in some way. Or having
yeah, a big part of water limitations could be regulations, actually.
Yeah. The water use, like their ability to produce their crops isn't limited by water or their livestock, but the fact that they have to manage a buffer or that there's regulations, the conservation kind of work that they have to do is a limitation.
So just to get to the point that I think you're interested in, like I said, demand is a problem. There just isn't enough money flowing into this little economic system in order to actually support itself, and just figuring out any way in which more revenue can come in is going to help it. But also, when you're there, looking at individual operations, how do you actually increase the profitability? How can they keep more of what they take in as revenue? We presented this to the farmers, and they gave us a lot of really great feedback. A lot of that had to do with trying to figure out like who it was who actually had a sustainable business plan. I mean, they observed that not everybody really knew how to run a business necessarily, and that farms are businesses. And so we dug into our data to see if we could get at that, and found some pretty interesting patterns.
In the whole profitability and revenue discussion, was it recognized that, you know, if I'm raising, you know, 50 head of beef cattle, and I, you know, sell it off, obviously I get a certain amount of revenue in, but I'm going to keep one of those beef for myself. I have it slaughtered and put it into my freezer. So it was the value of that meat, because over the course of a year, that's quite a bit of money that I didn't have to go to the grocery store to buy. I had it already.
And not to get sidetracked too much, but these are all self-reported figures, and so everyone did their own calculation. The interviewers were volunteers. So they weren't necessarily trained to.
The farmer may have added that.
They may have added it, they may not have. They may have counted paying their children, or they may not have, you know, that kind of stuff. They may have figured the mortgage in, they may not have. So when you really drill down into the economics, it's a little bit wanting. But this is just how they, what they perceive as their profit. But there's definitely some patterns that come out with that, and in order to increase profitability, increasing marketing practices, intensively farming small acreage, and improving or making sure that farming is occurring on good soils are really important. And just to show you how that works, we looked at all those farms that were grossing less than $50,000, and some of them had a positive net profit, so they were beginning to grow their operation and keep some money, and some of them, a lot of them, did not have any profit at all. So what was the difference between those two groups? Digging into that, we found that on average, the ones that had a positive profit used twice as many marketing practices as the ones who weren't making. And we asked them what all their marketing was, and there's this big list, and they just checked it off, and it's just this huge laundry list. It didn't matter what it was, but if you were doing twice as much, about nine practices, like Facebook page, direct marketing, you know, having a sign at the co-op, all that kind of stuff, you actually begin to be profitable. There's a lot of them are kind of doing their thing on the side, and they're like, no, don't, they're not doing it.
Is there any acknowledgement for the ones that aren't marketing for the value of marketing?
Not that I know of. So you take those smaller ones, Lee. We're just looking at the ones who are being profitable. The ones that have, not the smaller, the ones that aren't making any money, the ones that have kept some amount of money. We find that actually the very small acreages, so here's 5 acres, 5 to 50, and 50 to 500 acres of actively farmed, not the lot size they're actually using. The ones 5 acres actually have much higher profitability ratios. This is a 60% return. So if they do $100,000, they keep $60,000. Whereas the very large farms aren't as profitable.
But they could be ending up with a year with more money in the pocket, though.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the thing that they have to look at. Like, what's the benefit for them? It could be a really great profitable situation, but not enough total volume for things. Not a lot of questions were asked very in detail about the quality of the soil, but we had them rate their own soil in terms of different products. And the most demanding product is in terms of soil fertility and whatnot, is vegetables. They take a lot out of the inputs. And whether they considered it not good for vegetables or good for vegetables, farms that thought themselves on good soils for vegetables either recognized that or actually had a soil which is good for vegetables were twice as profitable as the ones on land that isn't good for vegetables, which is pasturage or whatnot. So being on a good soil or having infrastructure, if you're thinking that, having the infrastructure being located where good soils are is really important, because those farms actually do a lot better than the ones that are out where Doug firs are chopped down on some sort of glacial till. And it matters. If you look at the farms just on those good soils, like they figured they're good for vegetables. And they weren't all farming vegetables. They said, well, it's good for vegetables. Or they're doing vegetables, but this land is terrible and it's the only one I can afford. It went out of the way. But if you look at the years of operation from 0 to 14 years, the profitability ratio actually goes up pretty substantially over time. It's a little bit of a time substitution, but you would imagine that these are for 4 years old, when they're 8 years old, they might be twice as well in revenue as earnings. And the slope of this line is like 6%. So they actually take about 10 years to grow up a profitable operation if they're on a good soil, but it can be done, and it seems to be occurring. They identified a lot of solutions to the problems that they perceived. Regulation changes, it's mainly an uncertainty issue and lack of communication. And I don't know how you guys are involved in that, but definitely having very explicit ways that farmers can interact with regulations and having them know what the actual regulations are, and having staff and government consistently communicate the same things. There's also a lot of rumors, I think, that go around, and so they think a lot of stuff is regulated, isn't think it's when it's like that anymore. Sometimes when people help, they don't realize they've been helped, and carry a grudge, that kind of stuff. So communication is what regulations is about, except for value added. And this is maybe where you guys' infrastructure concerns come in, because they really see some particular things that need to happen with value added. Portable slaughterhouse is mentioned a lot, and meat processing is a really big issue. And basically, it's mainly done out of the state even, or out of the county for sure. That would be how those big animal producers actually increase the profitability, because they don't have trucking animals in ways. Having a lot of them are very small operations, and so being able to comply with the pretty strict regulatory environment, even having like a kitchen that's has an inspector come in, might be too much for them, because it's a small operation, it's on there, something collective might be.
The slaughterhouse would require quite a lot of water.
Yeah, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes, the portable slaughterhouse.
They had a lot of ideas about cooperative marketing and profitability that showed that they basically knew, at least intuitively, that that's true. And doing it cooperatively was something that was. So as you develop infrastructure and you're helping farmers, I think you'd also take a mind to think that this has to actually be communicated to everybody. Can't be something that you do in your buildings over here. You might want to think about labeling or having some sort of joint marketing thing, or at least like how the co-op has done the L local thing. If you had something that you were associated with, you might want to also figure a way of linking that up, making it a visual or some sort of recognizable emblem of that relationship. And the farmers are very interested in cooperating. We ask them about all different kinds of ways of cooperating, transportation and this and that. A third of them are interested in being on a food policy council to help different organizations in the county. county move through these policy decisions at the land use planning, which is very positive. A third of them want to actually share transport costs and be in some sort of transport for a while. And some are even interested in joint land ownership or alternative ways of having infrastructure or owning land. What I hope we've done is just given them a voice. They have a lot of opinions, and bringing them into a consensus is very challenging. But I think this is really what they are hinting at as things that need to be worked on. And different groups have their own concerns and power to do a lot of different stuff. But I think what it is like when we say that there is a lack of demand and the profitability isn't working, but they're interested in cooperating. Well, I think you need to take those things and think about how it is that you can bring what you know and your ideas to make that happen for them. Part of it is farmers are really busy, and it's hard to see the big picture and see exactly how it is that everyone can retool their operation to benefit them, to help with demand, to help with profitability, and to cooperate. And so I think it's really more of a creative leap for you guys to say, well, what is it that we do that we can actually help with these things, not farming to tell us what they need and then we have that. I think they need you to really get your juices going and come up with new ways that they can be helped. Because they really are focused on making the farming community a cornerstone of the economy in Jefferson County, and that is going to help everybody. And Citizens World of Food believes that we can really have a food system that strengthens our community, local community and our economy.
This year to address some infrastructure needs associated with Jefferson County agriculture. So there's a lot of discussion about aggregation, distribution or transport, as well as processing in agricultural systems, especially small scale agricultural systems. And last year we did have a feasibility study to look at using, for instance, the Courtesy Ford location as a potential food hub that could be used for aggregation, transport, and distribution, as well as processing. And we learned a lot of things from that. And then getting the results from this survey, as well as working with several different producers in not only Jefferson County, but Clallam County, and talking to really successful producers like Nash Huber as well about some of the specific needs for this particular region. And Nash Huber, he owns Nash's Organic Farm. He farms about 600 acres in the Dungeness Valley, and he is in the Dungeness Delta, and he's considered probably one of the most successful organic vegetable producers in the state. So he sells carrots in LA, so he does really, really well with his production system. And he's done quite a bit of infrastructure improvements himself for his own operation and been able to scale up in a way that we, and when I say we, I'm talking about Clallam County as well, that we would like to see. So I work a lot with Clea Realm, who's the Clallam County director. She used to be the RC&D coordinator, and now she's the director of WSU Extension in Clallam County. And Clea and I have talked quite a bit about, you know, how can we take farms that need to move up, you know, in terms of their economic activity to the next level. And they may be small acreage farms that are doing value added and they need more infrastructure to make that leap. Or they may be sort of mid-sized farms that need better processing facilities or access to distribution hubs to make that next leap up as well. So there's a couple of different...
You have a feel, we've encountered this in other industry sectors, it's kind of the Port Townsend lifestyle thing. There were, I would imagine, some percentage of the farms, especially the newer, smaller farms, are more of a hobby kind of thing. You know, maybe 5 acres is all I want to farm. I really don't want to become
a hobby operation. Yeah, there are. There's quite a few people who are hobby farming, and they're the ones that definitely rely, you know, the 97% figure on outside income. And they're not really, not all of them are really interested in turning a profit. They just want to farm for the lifestyle.
What? Yeah.
I wasn't there at the beginning of this process, but I know that Dick Bergeron and others vetted this list we brought in, and they have some desire to be commercial operators. They don't want to just, there's a lot of people who are growing food that we didn't include in this because they consider themselves to be doing it as a hobby. And the farmers that we did, at the very least, had some desire to be
commercial.
Not necessarily large scale, not like, oh, this is going to be my living, but they're getting some economic benefit out of it, and they're doing that as part of a diverse, you know, way of making a living in the rural environment. And I know, I think we kind of forget sometimes that people in rural areas rely on food production, at least to some extent, as a way of making rural life work. You know, you're out there, and you move from a lot of the infrastructure of the city and a lot of economic opportunities. And one of the ways you compensate for that is being able to grow food or eggs or whatever and make up for that and get some use out of your property.
A lot of those people were included in this survey, and so a lot of people who were not interested in being commercial farmers. I mean, I meet with people all the time that have 5 acres and they may have a couple horses, and they weren't included in something like this, and they're not making money.
Well, there's a good market for horses now, apparently.
So there's a couple things that have come out of this, and the challenges is and this is something that WSU is really focused on trying to do, is helping farmers understand collaborative and cooperative business models. And so, you know, and we've had some success with fiber producers. So we just recently got some funding from the Northwest Cooperative Development Center to start a fiber cooperative here on the peninsula. And that would be people who are producing fiber, animal fiber. They want to aggregate it. They want to process it together. They want to brand it together. And then they want to sell it locally, regionally, and nationally under a brand. And this is something that we really see as being lucrative for food producers as well. But the work that we did last summer showed that there was a couple people that were really interested, but they didn't understand the cooperative model well enough to be able to jump in and say, okay, I'm ready to be a player in this. So that's sort of a business side of things that WSU is trying to really work towards creating better connections and bringing information to the community, because I think a lot of infrastructure projects are going to be dependent on getting farmers to actually work collaboratively, either through a cooperative business model or some other sort of agreement.
A good example of that is a couple of Brits.
Yes.
They really marketed that well.
Exactly. And we have a couple really successful, you know, Oregon Natural Beef, which was started in Oregon. It's a cooperative business model that has been really, really successful. Organic Valley, you know, the Bishops have been really successful in being a part of that cooperative. So we do have some producers locally and regionally that are part of larger cooperatives that have been really, really successful. And it's a matter of getting some of them to be able to educate their neighbors and other producers about cooperative models and how they work, and the success that can be had with them. So I just wanted to put that out there. That is something that we're working on, because it came out of the work we did last summer looking at the Courtesy Ford location and potential for creating some infrastructure. That being said, there is a cooperative group, the Puget Sound Meat Producers Cooperative, and that is the mobile slaughter. And so one thing in particular that's been really pressing, and there's a tremendous amount of energy in the local community to move this forward, is having a kill site that is located in Jefferson County, really along that Rhodey Highway, the 19, and really even close to the crossroads, the 1920 intersection there, which fits in really well with the property that the court has, is having an actual kill site, and that's fairly straightforward, what's included in that, but then more importantly, actually having a cut and wrap site located on that site as well. So currently the closest place for the mobile meat slaughter to come and process meat on the peninsula is Beckabar Farm, which is located on Highway 101 going out towards Squim. And they currently have a kill site there. Kill site is having basically a cement slab, an area that you can hold animals, and then you're going to have to deal with the waste from the slaughter as well. And Roger Short has come forward and talked pretty openly about his interest in being able to actually do some of the animal composting that would be associated with something like that, as well as some other producers in the area. So having a particular site where that mobile unit can come, it's USDA inspected, so there's a USDA inspector there the entire time. They could potentially come 1 to 2 days a week, and we have the volume, and that volume would also increase once producers knew.
Do you have any idea what the water usage would be there at that site?
So you would have to spray down the site to be able to do it?
We would have to.
And the number,
would have to,
you would have to have
wash
water.
Everything, and we'd have to deal with the effluent that's...
And that's something that we could talk with the mobile producers about, because they may bring some of their own water with them when they come, because they have to clean out. They do organic in the morning, and then they do conventional animals in the afternoon. So they wash down their entire system themselves in between different operations.
I think our concern out at the airport site is not the availability of water.
Not the septic.
But it's the how do we handle the wastewater.
Yeah.
Because it's on top of a critical aquifer up there.
Well, and that's where we bring in the Conservation District and Rich Geiger, who's an engineer for the Conservation District. It deals with nutrient management plans of animal waste. And most of these nutrient management plans, you actually don't put water into a septic or into a sewer system. You have a different process in terms of managing that comes off that waste. Very similar to what they would do, for instance, with a dairy, where they would separate out the whey, they would separate out the different nutrients from the process, and then use them in different industries.
Now, are the farmers willing and able to pay some sort of fee for this?
To use the site? Well, they would be included. They do pay a premium right now to be able to have their animals slaughtered and have it USDA certified. Because it allows them to go into the retail market with that meat, and livestock production and meat is at a premium right now. So it's
we'd have to have some way of at least covering our costs.
Exactly.
You know, state law.
Well, and I think having a cut and wrap, and that's what's really important. It's not just having a place where the slaughter takes place, but there's absolutely no place in Jefferson County right now to process meat that's been butchered. So they have to go to Kitsap County, typically, or Clallam County to have that done. So we're missing out on a huge market, because we have a tremendous number of livestock producers. And you saw from this, most of them are the ones that are actually, those mixed operations are quite profitable, and they're doing fairly well, and they're fairly well established. Those, they're not new producers coming in. The mixed and livestock producers are producers that have historically been here for a long time, and they've lost that capacity. When we had the Food Hub meetings this summer, we got sidetracked every single time with meat processing. So every single time we tried to talk about cold storage, every single time we tried to talk about distribution, it kept me back. So that is definitely, in terms of priorities, what I see as being one of the top priorities in terms of infrastructure is being able to move that forward and being able to build in something like a cut and wrap facility that could be really regionally important as well. So we could potentially even draw North Kitsap and Clallam producers here to Jefferson. So the economic activity there would be really key. The other thing that's really important right now, and this goes back to looking at wholesale and the ability for farmers here to wholesale. So we have companies like Charlie's Produce, which is the number one wholesaler in the state of Washington. And Charlie's comes up here to deliver, but they go back with an empty truck. And that's really unfortunate, because, and it goes back to some business planning, which WSU is obviously trying to work on getting farmers to actually know the true cost of production, so they can enter into contracts that are economically viable for them. But with the Food Safety Modernization Act, farmers now are required to be what's called GAP certified, which is good agricultural practices. And places like Charlie's and PCC and Whole Foods are no longer going to be purchasing food and produce from farms that aren't GAP certified. And GAP certification has a lot to do with how you process and handle fruits and vegetables, and having a processing center where farmers could actually come in and on a very large scale wash their potatoes, wash their produce, package it. So Charlie's, you know, you have to package your fruit in a certain way or package your vegetables in a certain way. And that is one of the things that took Nash's farm from, you know, he used to do it under a tree with a bunch of coolers and a hose, to having an actual packing house on his farm where he's able to not only be the number one distributor, the number one vegetable producer and distributor on the peninsula, but distributing nationwide now his produce. So that, and he says that's what took him from, you know, sort of that low mid-level producer up to that next notch where he actually has the capital now to make major improvements in his farm.
What would you anticipate the volume of animals?
The number of animals?
In Jefferson County, in the adjoining counties to be slaughtered.
We would likely have, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, you know, we could probably do one day a week of slaughter and fill the slaughter to capacity, and that would be with beef cattle, lamb, and pigs. And so that's, you know, I'm thinking of probably 500 head of cattle a year that could potentially be slaughtered there that would be that are currently being slaughtered, but being slaughtered outside of the community that could be slaughtered
500
here.
Head a year.
500 head of cattle a year, I think, is what we could look at as being presently slaughtered. It's either custom slaughter or they're taking their cattle out of the county to have it slaughtered. So, for instance, Roger Short slaughters between 75 and 100 head himself a year, and he does that down in Portland.
Bundy, one of those.
And Bundy would be one of them as well. And then we have other mid-sized producers. Those are the two of the larger producers. Westbrook Angus slaughters between 30 and 50 head a year. So those are just three right there that would make up probably half the capacity for using a mobile slaughter. And then having the cut and wrap facility available as well. And one of the things that would be really key for the cut and wrap would also be meat processing, being able to do bacon, sausage, jerky, and all of those other things that really create that high value. And it's really that niche marketing that's taking place right now.
I lived across the street in Yakima from a slaughterhouse, and it was kind of smelly from occasionally.
Yeah, but this wouldn't be a slaughterhouse, so they would come and they would go, and the waste would be managed very efficiently. So, and I don't know out by the airport if there's many neighbors.
We've already pissed them all off.
Oh, yes, there you go. There you go. So, you know, I think looking at there's and processing is two things. It's really having that a commercial processing facility where things can be washed, and you have the sinks and the, you know, the type of surfaces that the WSDA requires, and then also looking at that next step, which would be where we have people with WSD processing licenses, and they can't use domestic kitchens to do that kind of processing.
Now, wastewater would be the issue for us.
It would be, and that would be dependent on the kind of activities that people would be doing. So there's minimal processing that takes place when you're bagging vegetables, for instance, but then you would have, obviously, with some of the value-added enterprises, there would be more water associated. So
what would be involved in a cut and wrap? It's just basically a nice clean building with clean surfaces and not a lot of effluent to go into the septic.
And cold.
So it has to have a freezer.
Yeah, you'd have to have cold storage there. Mm-hmm. So and aging rooms. Mm-hmm. So
it doesn't have to be a freezer necessarily.
Right, just a cooler and some clean stuff. In other words, there's no excessive water requirements because you're not really doing anything except just cutting in.
Exactly.
The water department would be for the slaughter part.
Yeah, that would be the slaughter part.
You said there were some solutions that they have for separating out the water from the other stuff?
Exactly. So
we could do that on our property with our septic?
That would be required. I mean, the working with Susan Porto.
Develop our type of septic would handle it.
Would be something older system?
Well, I think working with Susan Porto from Jefferson County, she does all the water management plans. So working with her and Rich Geiger from the Conservation District. So he's the engineer who works in this entire, on the entire peninsula on developing nutrient management plans for animal production and animal processing systems. So the two of them together, and they're the ones right now, for instance, who are working with Mount Townsend Creamery to get the brown dairy up and running based on the fact that they don't have public water and they also don't have access to sewer. They have septic that cannot handle the amount of waste that's going to come from cheese production out there.
So there's a solution.
Yeah, there's definitely.
Yeah, I think what would have to do, we've got public water, which satisfies part of the problem the creamery's having with using well water. But eventually, it would have to sit down with the county and just see what they would allow and not allow. I think we'd have to first sit down with you and the folks you just mentioned to make sure we understand what's possible, what are the costs.
Well, and we're lucky that Julie Boggs from Westbrook Angus is on the board of the Puget Sound Meat Producers Cooperative. So she would be really, she'd be more than happy and very accessible to be able to come in and provide a whole overview of the mobile slaughter
system.
Seems like
the B&B would want to be in.
Just to be clear, the Brown Farm is going to be serviced by PUD Water if they get it. So PUD Water is right at the corner.
They're going to pull it. Are they going to pull it there?
I remember initially they were concerned about well.
But also know that our septic system is maxed out. We can't do any more building, so there'd be a new system.
At the airport.
Yeah, for the industrial park. Yeah.
I was at an interesting thing the other day. We were too busy, we couldn't attend that. But Team Jefferson put on a session for producers, and I was there as a landlord and a producer. But it was pretty interesting hearing the needs of, and a lot of the things you said are very true of this demand.
Yeah.
You know, is there demand? Can
well, and like the co-op and the Chimicum Corner Farm Store stands say this all the time, that they need more value-added products to put on their shelves. So, you know, they would love to be able to see, I think about 40% of the co-op produce area is local, but the rest of the store, it just diminishes from there. And so where can we find those products that we can fill in on the shelves? And I know the 4%, you know, how much do we consume in Jefferson County? It's right about 4% of what we're what we consume is locally produced, and how do we increase that number as well?
But the issue was getting our product to Seattle.
Yeah.
And right now, and as a producer, I know it's not worth my time to deliver a case of Seattle.
No, it's not.
So what we really need is a distribution center.
We do, but we also need, and this is something that I feel, you know, and a third of all the people surveyed said they needed transport. They needed help with transport. When we were working out at Courtesy Ford this summer, that was the one of the number one beyond meat processing. It was transport and distribution. And that is something that is a huge need, but there also needs to be people willing to work collectively together. And so that's where, you know, just from the work we did, we saw the farm stand and the co-op partner to do some collective transport together, as well as collective storage just coming out of that. But how do we bring enough people together to make that economically viable?
We toured a thing in Walla Walla, they have a Railex facility there where all the producers park on one side of a building, take their produce and put it in the building, and on the other side there's trains that in 6 days are going to be on the East Coast for five days.
Yeah. And that's, I was giving an example of wanting to actually visit places like Walla Walla and bring back
some
examples.
You get the railroad back here again?
No, but I mean, there can be trucks on both sides, you know?
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I think we really need is some people who are really interested in that business and want to come into the community and take on a distribution business. Like Pandemori has said, we have vehicles that aren't used every day of the week and every hour of the day that we'd be willing to lease out to someone who wants to use them. We already see some people that are transporting together. So Dharma Ridge partners to get their produce over to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They provide produce for the cafeterias on the at that campus. How do we take our producers to that? You know, to how do we bring them up to that level? And it is through collectively transporting goods together. It's just trying to get them to understand that business model and to feel comfortable with it.
And as you get some of the smaller successes behind you, other opportunities suddenly come into view, and some outsiders will say, geez, I could go create this business up in Jefferson County.
Well, and that was the problem with the Courtesy Ford
did U-Haul just
leave? U-Haul bought it. It was purchased outright. But one of the problems with the zoning of that building is that it is not zoned for wholesale. So you can't hold anything there. Any place that would be a distribution center would have to be zoned wholesale, because there would have to be the ability to store those goods, whether it's just for a day or a week or a month.
And that's one of the issues that the county really had to take. We looked at buying Courtesy Ford site, but the zoning is what turned us off. We couldn't do anything with it.
And the zoning out at the airport industrial park is zoned?
It's like light industrial.
Okay.
Not commercial.
Okay.
So you wouldn't be able to sell anything there, but processing and...
And wholesaling.
Yeah.
Because that would have to be, if you're going to do transport, you'd have to have, a transport center would have to be. And I think one of the things that I'm really hoping to do is to get enough producers GAP certified and feeding them into Charlie's and other distribution companies, so that we can build capacity in the community and then eventually have our own distribution company as well. But I think right now, you know, one of the things is trying to actually get them, because Charlie's comes up, so Charlie's will transport their goods, but we don't have enough farmers right now that are actually knowledgeable about the cost of production. So they can't even negotiate with Charlie's, because Charlie's will say, well, how much do you want for your goods? And they'll say, oh, I don't really know. Like, what are you paying other producers? And Charlie's wants them to say, I want this. This is what I need per item. And Diane from Charlie's has said that time and time again. She's going to come up in April and do a workshop that we're going to hold at the Gardner Community Center with producers to educate them specifically on that. So,
so to make that link work with Charlie's and the GAP producers, you need to have a central location for these GAP approved producers to bring their produce
and
pick it up, and that
exactly.
would be a cold storage facility.
Cold storage and a place where they could process, like, you know, where they could clean carrots and clean beets and clean potatoes and potentially package them, and then that would build capacity for aggregation, where producers can start aggregating similar commodities.
And then that would probably have enough people together so that the people that are wondering, should I delve into the transport because there's not enough here, I'll suddenly have more that they can
transport. Exactly. And then that also will, and then that feeds into institutional purchasing. So hospitals, schools, you know, there's a lot of momentum right now for farm to school initiatives, and how do we get more local food into our institutions? And we need to build volume in Jefferson County to be able to do that. So we can't just expect right now that we have farmers that are producing enough surplus that they could all of a sudden funnel it into a hospital or into a school system. Without aggregation of their goods. So.
From a port point of view, the industrial park probably isn't the place to site anything for us. It would probably be the old rental house place on Highway 20, because it has better access to the highway than the industrial park would have. So it would be a whole rezone anyway. It would take the cooperation of the county to
it's
take
about
that
10-acre parcel that we have right on Highway 20.
But the industrial park, having all the farmers come in, some is going out, it just really isn't designed that way.
And I've been really, you know, one of the things that I have made a priority is working on regulation and policy with the county. So I've had 3 workshops now, and I've done a lot of facilitation between the county and producers when they're going through zoning and permitting processes. So I feel really confident in being able to, you know, if it's something the port wants to just even scope out and have the certain county agencies there to just talk about the feasibility of something like that. I'd be really happy to.
Yeah, it's all the 10 acres that Jim just mentioned. It's got commercial water and it's right smack dab. Probably got 6,000 feet of frontage on Highway 20 right there.
Wow.
This is the ideal spot.
Yeah, as you're coming through the Four Corners towards courtesy Ford.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about 200 yards on the right.
Well,
before
and
you get to the airport.
And one of the things that we're talking about right now is potentially even having the kill site at the Short Farm, because Roger already has everything there, and then having a cut and wrap close by. So it could even be that with the you know, if the nutrient management plan doesn't work out, and if there is some challenge to having a kill site located there, we may still be able to work with a local producer. It could be Bundy, it could be Short, or someone else who actually already has animal holding infrastructure, has the cement slab, and has the ability to deal with the waste. So, you know, it's just always hard when you're dealing, that's the problem with Bekavar, is that he doesn't always want someone coming onto his land. He's very limited to the number of days he'll allow the mobile slaughter unit to come there. So we can't meet demand with that site because it's on a private property. And so the property owner has the final say about, so it doesn't matter if there's 10 producers in Clallam that want slaughter in a week, they're not going to get it unless Bekavar is open to having the slaughter unit come. So that's always a challenge dealing
in
with
your that. Survey, did you collect actual numbers, like what's the total acreage being farmed
in Jefferson County?
Yeah, number of head of beef cattle, number of head of dairy cattle.
We have a total acreage of the people we talk to, and you could extrapolate that, you know, 70% maybe.
The USDA census had data from 2007, and then we'll be getting that data from 2012. And the trend that the census was showing was an increase in the number of farms, but a decrease in overall farmland because those farms are smaller.
The difference between that and we can look at it, but one thing that we focused on in the analysis was they told us exactly how much acreage they were using, and they also told us the size of the parcel, which were usually different. So I think that the ag census just goes on the size of the parcel, so that will be more apparent acreage than what we're saying, because we're talking about exactly what it is using farm. It's quite different to have like a 10-acre parcel and 4 acres.
It'd be interesting. I got a whole bunch of things I'll give you that I found going through the archives. You know, the 1925 farm census. There's a total of 350 farms in Jefferson County.
Yeah.
32,015 acres.
And that's
in farms.
I bet we probably have a tenth of that right now.
Yeah.
That's actually in production.
You know, 436 horses, 3,500 cattle with an additional 300 other beef cattle, whatever that is.
You other know, beef cattle?
Other, yeah.
So there's a problem because back then they did count horses as ag land and left them out because like, oh, that's a recreational hobby. But
that almost 300 head of dairy cattle.
I think that the Team Jefferson session that we attended was, I think they implied that build it and they will come. I mean, the reason we don't have a lot is because we don't have the infrastructure to deal with it.
Well, if they can help us with grants to build it, we'd be happy to.
Well, we talked about, USDA does have money.
Yeah, that's what you said.
That's where the money would have to come from to do it.
And I think an even better route to do that would be through the RCND. So the RCND has made it their priority to focus on agricultural development, and Clea Rome and I are co-managing the coordinator for the RCND, and having the RCND work on some infrastructure grants with the USDA, I think, would be really successful.
We've never had a reason to really go to the Department of Agriculture money.
Yeah.
So it's a whole untapped source from the forest perspective.
Well, we better hurry up if we want the RCND to do it.
Yeah. Since the Department of Agriculture got their funding last year.
Yeah. Well, and we're hoping that, obviously, the coordinator is able to get some funds to continue working throughout, make it a sustainable position into the future. And I agree. I mean, I think there is some truth to build it and they will come, but I also think understanding the volume and capacity in the community and knowing that...
Well, this survey would be a great aid in soliciting funds.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Of course, we have to realize that there's some other services that are people that wouldn't be served, like the shellfish industry, which wasn't even included in here, and they would likely use the transportation and the cold storage and distribution channels.
Well, yeah, that's very true, and many of our producers have relied on the shellfish producers for refrigerated transport. So, for instance, Roger Short used to transport all of his processed meat from Portland with Hamahama when they would come back from delivery. And Adam from Hamahama has been really, really involved in, even though they're in Mason County, he comes to all of our Jefferson County events and sort of feels affinity with Jefferson County ag producers and has cooperated with them quite a bit with transport. And I know some of the other shellfish producers with the refrigerated trucks have been really working cooperatively with farmers when they have to transport. So that has been something that's worked out. Yeah. I agree, though, having cold storage where they could even potentially aggregate or have a hub would be really, really important. So, thank you. Any other questions?
I think maybe staff can sit down and maybe some other folks we need to sit down with and just get a better feel for some of the infrastructure, what would be required to do some of these things, and then see if any of the port properties kind of come close to matching that capability, and then maybe sitting down with the county. And the restrictions with zoning are so difficult in this county still. I know the county commission, have you briefed the county commissioners yet?
Yeah, they did talk, not the county commissioners, but they talked to the planning commission.
And the county commissioners need to hear this too, because sometimes I'm not sure they understand how difficult it is out there for a small business, whether it's ag, marine trade, anybody that, you know.
I know David Sullivan has seen the presentation 3 times. And I don't know.
Yeah, he was there last week.
Yeah, and I don't know if John Austin or if Phil Johnson has seen it yet, but I'm assuming that they probably, I don't know if either of them were at the planning commission.
Well, your thing about, Jim, at your meeting last week about storage farms, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, we talked with Midori Farm,
uh-huh.
was the big person, and also we talked about Townsend Creamery on utilizing Atlas Technologies possibly and doing refrigerated containers. Doing insulated container refrigeration. But part of the county regulations is you can't have a bunch of containers sitting around the farm.
Yeah.
You permit some. But that's an easy way to have security and storage, easily refrigerated, low power consumption. So one of the ideas we came up with was maybe if we utilize the airport site is for us to come up with some kind of infrastructure that would allow container storage,
mm-hmm.
that would have the power infrastructure and allow people to have a condominium, secured locker, if you will.
Yeah, we just do a low-cost land lease.
It was actually a great session of TGFs.
And we talked with them, with Atlas, this summer, because they also participated in the feasibility of the food hub out at Courtesy Port, and they were really interested in putting in the vacuum-packed storage facilities as well for berry producers and meat producers. Additionally, and again, the problem with zoning, because you have to have you have to be able to wholesale something in the permit that you have.
And that's something that the airport, the county would have to allow us to do.
Yeah.
But collectively, we thought pretty much somehow the collective community together, the county would listen to that agricultural collection.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Phil Johnson is, he's an ex-commercial fisherman, so he kind of is hip to the pull them out of the water and sell them.
Yeah, definitely. But I think that is going to be, working with Carl Smith and community development on storage and wholesaling, because that was the big hang up that we ran into as well, and difficult to get around.
But the commissioners, they're the ones that would modify the zoning.
Well, the planning commission has to recommend it first. So it has to go through the planning commission.
They go through a public hearing and all the rest of the process. And it took us over 10 years to get the rezone at the airport.
Well, and I feel somewhat, I have tempered optimism about the next Complin amendment, or the going on forward, that hopefully it will be favorable towards
that. Well, not to wish ill will on all of us, but, the recession has really helped us in that regard. It's finally caused people to realize that, maybe we need to loosen up some of the stuff.
Yeah.
Instead of zoning out of fear, let's be proactive and zone for ourselves.
Exactly. Okay, well, and I think having someone like Julie Boggs, if we meet again, to be able to be at the table to talk about the logistics of the mobile slaughter, and then I'll invite the RC coordinator also in case something comes forward that we want to look at for as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank
good.
You.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let me just give this back. Great. All sorts of stuff for put together.
Nice. We'll hang it up in the Cooper House. Great. Thank you.
Anyone else want to take a break or go into the next topic?
I just assumed getting moving on to the next issue.
Team Jefferson, EDC. What do we want to do?
Their deliverables seem negligible.
Well, and I think staff feels pretty much the same way. We've been talking, Eric Tate and I, about, and Amy, if we're going to continue funding them for 2013, then I think we need to be more specific in giving them a few tasks that directly support us. Now, here's what we want you to do between now and December 31st. Be very clear on what that is. One of the things that just came up, because we're going through this PSAC process on the strategic plan, much to our dismay, we found that we're supposed to be doing an annual economic summit in the community. We the poor. That's what we said we'd do. Well, that's an area that, Team Jefferson should be doing annual economic summit. So maybe we can kind of hand it off to them to put this thing together, maybe this coming fall, and organize it. I just noticed Port of Vancouver is doing one. They do it around a community breakfast. I don't know if that's a good idea for us to do a breakfast or a lunch or just do some sort of a session, maybe a morning session, and invite the other governments, certain other economic stakeholders, business community, etc. So that could be one of them. The other one could be if we want to do something with the ag industry, have Peter help us with this, to go to USDA, look for grants. Marketing, some of our properties, that sort of thing.
One of the things we said we'd do in the strategic plan was to create a brochure to market pork properties. And maybe we could task them with doing an actual marketing brochure of pork properties.
That's three things that fit totally into their mission
now. Well, the other big thing that...
The one about... feathering in with egg, they're already doing, it sounds like. That would fit right in there without much extra effort on their part. Making a brochure and holding an economic summit is a pretty reasonably sized task.
So. Yeah.
But right now we get nothing from them other than thank you very much. We couldn't do it without you.
I think it's again, it's communication. We've never communicated to them that they had to do something specific to pork. It was more community-based. I'm not defending them at all, because I don't think that delivers
well, very no, good. Their requirements with us are quite clear. We have to have deliverable.
Did you read the contract? It doesn't really say that. We talked about that.
Well,
the contract doesn't say that.
The state laws require us to get a return for whatever money we put out, right?
Yeah, but it's pretty loose. I mean, talking to Amy as a state auditor, it's pretty loose. If the community benefits from it, then... But back to our original thing of tasks, I think one of the biggest tasks needed that's directly related to the port is education on government contracts. They need to conduct classes for our marine trades on how to be certified to do government jobs. I think that would be a great task, but it's educational.
I think the port ought to become the ADO, but receive the money and drive the EDC.
I agree, but it'll never happen. The county runs the show. So the county has to agree to that, and I just...
Well, if we ran that by Timmons, because Timmons not contributing because he has issues with the agency, and Morley, and say, you know, we're the economic development driver here, you know, the port is. Why don't you put it in our arsenal so that we can...
Like Port of Walla Walla. And,
but yeah, then possibly. We'll have port employees doing packaging plants for the farm industry, and be working with the, I mean, that will expand the scope of the port so drastically in the community that we would have to have a ton of people support that.
It would be way more expensive than supporting the EDC.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
it would
no
be
way.
Considerably more expensive. Then
we wouldn't be talking about boat builders. We'd be talking about all sorts of things.
Well, I don't know. You know, last time I was at the Port of Chelan, which is right there in Wenatchee, is where their port, Edmund building is.
Boy, they've got some money in that operation.
Yep. I should just have Peter Quinn, whoever that is, his office is in the Port Edmund building. But I don't think they have any other people. You know, they use the Xerox machine and...
In the conference room
and the conference room to have meetings.
Well, the port of Grace Harbor,
the city and the county give the port substantial monies. And Port of Walla Walla, county and the city, you know, that's the thing over there. You've got the three entities, three governmental entities, all supporting each other.
Yeah, and the port's
got the EDC.
When you look at Jefferson County and how diverse we are, we're a lot more diverse than Chelan.
Yep.
Oh, definitely.
You know, I mean, we've got definitely so many facets to this community that we would need somebody that's pretty broad. We're not just ag. We're not just boat building. We're not just retail. I mean, we've just got tons. I agree with you, Dave. I just don't know politically.
Well, are you suggesting a change in the head of the EDC?
Well,
would be more.
No, we're just debating whether
we should fund them or not.
We should fund them or not.
Now, they did provide what we asked for in their, this is the scope of services that we filled out for.
Mm-hmm.
And it pretty much matches what they have to provide Department of Commerce. And that's the report. You know, it's number of workers trained, number types of jobs, a range of compensation, number of types of businesses that were served, percentage of jobs created, you know, number of businesses cited. All those things. And I, you know, this was our first blush at, and I think we just kind of use that as a template, but this can be totally rewritten, you know, to say you'll do that plus these three tasks or four tasks, whatever we.
Well, you know, since the EDC used their new offices and to get Quimper Mercantile going and then turn back on to their primary task, which was running the EDC, it has done a lot of good. I mean, they have done a lot of good. They've got that YPN deal going, which has got some headway to it.
They are conducting business classes on how to write business plans.
How to write business plans. Peter seems relatively articulate, although a little bit of a joker with his Quimper Mercantile routine. And if our funding should leave, they will fold up and close the doors. That'll be
yeah, good. No doubt, because the city provides nothing. And I met with Timmons a week and a half ago.
What did Timmons have to say about the city's decision to use them more in the marketing genre?
He didn't really mention that. Yeah, we're talking more, you know, is the city ever going to come to the table financially to support the EDC?
And that's where you got a definitive answer on that.
Right, which is a negative.
Right.
You said they're never going to do it?
In Timmons' mind. Now, the city council obviously can change that.
Yeah, and I know that there's a couple of city council people that are leaning towards actually doing something, but they kind of have their hands tied.
Well, if the EDC was no longer the EDC, it was just a branch of the port, would that change the...
It might. I'd really have to analyze that to see if, from a staff perspective, if we can, not just so happens with our new building, if we ever get a build, does have an extra office in it.
But, well, yeah, but the effort for running an EDC out of the port is going to take a considerable investment in our dollars. And if you look at our overall budget, and perhaps you could point out to me where that money would be coming from.
Well, of course, you got to realize we'd be getting the money from the county and from the money that we would be giving them. And perhaps if we got the city on, that could be some substantial.
And there's a little bit of state money, you know, until the legislature is done. We don't know how much for 2013 is going to be coming out of the
Olympics. Right now, they're running on just a little under 90,000 bucks.
Right.
And that could go down from the state perspective.
If it was a port employee, just by the time you hire somebody,
uh-huh.
burden that person, you task Sue with 50 more projects, because she's going to be the answer.
And the commission would have more meetings because you become the EDC board. That's how these other ports are organized. You don't have a
20-man
board.
Off the cuff guesstimate it would cost us a year.
Another 100,000.
In addition to the 90, you mean?
Probably. In effort and time.
No, not in total.
In total.
50,000 total.
Total, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 60,000.
Yeah.
Now, they could stay in the same building they're in.
Uh-huh.
That way.
But that's taking a $25,000 a year step in that we give them now and turn it into $150,000 a year.
Would the county and the city be willing to make up that difference?
Well, those are some conversations we should probably have with the county and the city.
Wow.
Because we actually are the entity, you know, given the whole thing, go out and do the economic development. So,
first we should impose the three conditions we spoke about earlier. Number one, that's what we should do first.
Which is conditions?
The returnables.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we should burden them with those returnable tasks. So it would be nice to see that written up in some
kind. And that has to come out of the 25,000 we're already given.
Absolutely. Not, yeah.
Here's your 25 plus here's another 3,000 to do this.
And then we should enjoin the talks with the county. Because I think they're gonna have some pretty serious reservations. I know the county commissioners pretty well. And I don't think that's going to be a slam dunk.
One of the issues that Timmons has, and I've spoken to him many times about it, is that he wants input on who the director is. And the reason he's not funding now is he was told Peter Quinn's the director and we're going to live. But that ties our hands more if we were the entity, the city and county would want an equal share of who's going to run the show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something we have to consider.
Yeah. Yeah, the
way to approach that would be to put out a job announcement, and if Peter wants to reapply, so to speak, he can. But it also give a chance to others, but they're by the city and the county would both be at the table too.
Yeah.
And if Peter's reselected, then they can't bitch about it.
What's the county's contribution to the EDC now? 30,000?
There's 17 from the state. That's questionable. 30,000 from the county.
Uh-huh.
25 from us.
Yeah.
It used to be quite a bit more. Well, they used to get two other sources. In the old days, the PDD got like 80,000 from the feds.
Uh-huh.
And they would just split it in half, get 40,000 to the EDC in column.
Yeah.
30,000 Jefferson County EDC.
Right.
That's
gone.
That's gone.
Boy, that really shrunk up Clallam.
And then the Department of Commerce used to be about another 35 or 40, and every year that's been whittled down to where it is now.
Now, which was that? The one that was
Department of Commerce.
Oh.
The State Department.
Now that's down to 17.
Right. That used to be up in the mid 30 range.
Boy, I bet they don't get that 17 next year.
They're counting on.
Well, good luck.
90,000 is about the minimum they can operate.
Yeah, right.
If they don't get it, then it'd be up to the city and the port to.
One of the things that Eric wanted to talk about, he couldn't be here, is I think Eric and I, anyway, and I think Larry's bought into this too, and speak up if you haven't, but, you know, One of the issues we had last year with the EDC is they were doing classes and other things not related to that building. So we changed the structure by state law to make them pay rent, and then we gave them $1,000, basically switching.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, the EDC board has changed, and they are not doing any extracurricular activities. And I think legally, we can actually donate that building to them now at no charge. They still have to pay state leasehold tax on it. That would help perception of not giving $37,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Eric and I are on board, since they vowed that they're not going to do these kind of extra things in there. Only the EDC office. It would make life a lot easier from an accounting perspective if we just donated the building to the EDC to operate. Amy, I don't know if you take a stab at that. That's your thing. Because right now the perception is we're giving them $37,000, when in actuality they're giving us 12 of that 37 back for rent. It's just a
so we would forego the 12 and give them 25.
Yeah.
And the rent. I mean, the free rent.
Yeah, and the free use of the building.
Rent, yeah.
Now, that building, well, you've all been in the building. It's not something you immediately turn around and rent to a marine trader configuration. So, you know, it would be foregoing any possible rent. It used to be a beauty salon or something at one time. But
you can't make any decisions on this, but we wanted to tee that up and let you know the logistics of where that is.
Yeah, we've got the spring WPPA conference coming up.
In down on the Columbia River somewhere?
Yeah, that's Skamania.
Yeah.
And you saw the email where they want me to brief.
They want you to give a talk.
Yeah. How good we've been doing.
Yeah. I knew it was about our time. The last time was about 5 years ago that we gave one of the pitches, you know, all the four reports. And that's no problem. Ready to do that. But maybe if we're all down there, we ought to capture the director and some of the commissioners from the Port of Douglas, or the Port of Chelan, the Port of Walla Walla. There's a couple others that have the EDC under their umbrella. Maybe just sit down and talk with them as to, you know, how they work it, and do they have additional staff that's the chase floor, right, how expensive kind of services do they do? I know Walla Walla, the Port Commission, is the EDC Board of Directors.
Oh, okay.
They don't have a broad 20-person board. But they sit down on a regular basis with the city and the county electeds, you know, to let them know what is happening within the EDC. So.
I don't think the city has any say in designating the ADO. You know, it would only be the county.
Yeah, that's under state law.
But if the port was directing the EDC, it seems reasonable that we give a report to the county and the city.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And if we were to hire a director, even though by law it's the county that appoints, well, no, because we're the ADO, it's not the individual.
Mm-hmm. We would be the ADO, but they would have to.
Yeah, they got to appoint us, the port, as the ADO.
Right.
But obviously, if they're putting money, you know, they deserve to be at the table to vote as to who the director is and that sort of thing.
Oh, it'd be good to involve them so they can't complain about it. They don't like it, like you said.
Timmons really feels that, you know, the EDC is not providing anything of value that the city uses.
But then you get told by different city council members that they plan on interacting more with the EDC.
They need to tell their city manager that.
Huh? Yes.
He's not planning on it.
Huh.
Well, while we write up maybe those three or so tasks.
Yeah.
Redraft.
Four tasks.
Yeah. So. Redraft our contract. Yeah, I'll let you look at it. And
so just to reiterate, it's look for money for ag.
Help us with the annual summit.
Annual summit, the brochure on marketing for properties, and the classes on
government procurement.
Yeah.
Those really, you know, the summit will take some effort, you know. But you know, the classes on government procurement, I already know a guy down in Bremerton.
Oh, that gives him?
That, you know, he works for the federal government on how to do business with the federal government.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you follow up, say, when you come up here next week.
But I do think we need to be vigilant with this, what I'm told by the mayor, that the city plans on using them for marketing tourism.
We'll check on that.
Because that comes out of our pocket. And I don't think that is the way that we want to spend our money.
Our money is for the things that the board needs. Obviously, chunk of that goes to the salary. And
did they happen to mention if they were going to be supporting the EDC?
Well, that was the first question out of my mouth, and he gave me answer B-1, which is no, we pay our taxes to the county, and we depend on the county to support the EDC with our tax money that we duly pay in, ignoring the fact that the port also pays taxes to the county, which I had a little fun with at the meeting the other day.
Yeah. All right, well, let's sit down there.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Get something going here.
And then, you know, you find out about this Timmons not liking Quinn stuff later, you know.
Now there's an issue with the former mayor, I think, and Catherine Burrell.
Catherine Burrell was probably the biggest issue now that she's gone. It's true. It's public knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll put something together, rewrite our contract, let you look at it. Quick update, just to add one more thing. I just talked to David King, because the real reason why, one of the reasons why I met with Timmons the other day is to get the Katai process moving.
Yes.
And we talked to Watts, Timmons and I, and Watts is still under impression that everything's got to be wrapped up into a tight ball before any signatures are done. So I grabbed David King the other day and said, you got to help us with this thing. You know, this has just gone on way too long. You know,
yeah.
We've given all our property to you. You know, let's sign the deal and end it. You know, we've got work to do on the two wharfs. We got to put the floats back in. They need maintenance. We got to do signage.
We got potential customers.
We have the cruise ship fiasco that just happened. The cruise ship was coming in, which is great with us. But the city said, no, you can't dock there.
Well, why?
Yes, they can. Yeah.
The city's under the impression that RCO forbids it, but it's
the RCO does.
Right hand not telling the left hand of the city what's going on.
Oh.
So we need to get it under our operational purview. And so King, I think, understands that, and he's going to go back and rattle the cage a little bit. But if you see him again, you might want to.
Most important is we want to stop paying stormwater fees.
And that's the other, I kind of accused Watts of that. I said, you know, you're delaying this because you can't afford to stop getting that $2,000 a month out of us. He kind of laughed. But part of me thinks that's true.
Yeah, it is dragging on a bit. I'm getting quite a few queries as to what is going on there.
And King even kind of alluded to it. He's the speaker of the chamber.
Right. I missed that. I'm sorry. Yeah. I meant to go.
Oh, he was the speaker?
Yeah.
I made that up with somebody else.
Except the other scary thing is he raised in the speech is that he thinks we need to revitalize the joint economic strategy that never went anywhere, if you remember.
Well, we can revitalize it, but we're starting from scratch. Remember all the marine-related stuff that Sandoval threw out of the original agreement? Remember all that?
Yeah, all the real estate stuff. She didn't like the cluster.
Yeah, she threw out anything that referenced marine trades in that original document. Remember, I wrote an email to King and said, what the hell? There's 30 pages missing here that have been deleted. And it had anything to do with marine trades. Michelle Sandoval deleted it arbitrarily. And John didn't say anything about it. And so it was going to proceed ahead.
John Collins.
Because he was kind of our elected lead on the process.
And you talk about a bureaucratic waste of time.
It does go forward. Eric can't manage this. They threw it all at Eric.
Oh, there's
we
no did, way.
We end up writing the whole thing.
Remember all the little charts and just crazy shit.
There
was documents that thick that said nothing.
Because Al Skelton, remember, was getting close to retirement. But just kind of, he didn't care about it. And the city just said, well, you know, why don't Eric just come up with a new draft? We'll look at it. You know, well, Eric, you know, it's 10 hours of his life.
Per week.
Yeah, there was a, God, an unbelievable amount of paperwork generated for nothing.
All righty. Ready for a busy meeting this afternoon?
We got enough chairs for pilots coming out?